promotion is worth so much more than the money.
Content is still king.
Social media is completely your brand.
The social media is acting as a catch net.
Welcome back to the Music Marketing Podcast. Before we jump in, I just want to apologize because unfortunately our microphone wasn't working for this. Our guest was, so you hear him perfectly, but ours is a little bit muffled. But the podcast is a fantastic one. It definitely adds a lot of value, so we thought it was definitely worth putting out. The guest is Plastician, known for his work with Skepta, one of the true pioneers of both dubstep and grime. So hopefully you can forgive the audio and give it a shot and let us know what you think.
Welcome back to the Burst Mode Music Marketing Podcast. Today we are with Chris Reed, also known as Plastician. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, fan of the show.
So Chris was going to tell us a bit about his background in music. He is a DJ, producer, and also has his own record label. Do you want to tell everyone a bit about your background in music and how you got into it?
So my initial kind of introduction to music was quite late. I'd say, like, as much as I was listening to music growing up, it wasn't like a passion until I went to college, like 17. I was in like a graphics course at the time and used to just like sort of skim the FM dial for something to listen to while I was working on coursework, that kind of thing. And then I kind of like stumbled across pirate radio and UK garage music and was really taken aback by how much I enjoyed that, and just sort of trying to find out how, you know, we didn't have digital music back then, so trying to find those tracks. Then I, like, speaking to people I went to college with who were DJs and told me where I could buy records. So it went from listening to the radio to like buying records in independent stores, and then picking up a set of decks, learning to mix. And my first job in the industry was, I think I was 19, so I'd been DJing for about a year and a half at that point, just doing pirate radio stations, house parties, that kind of thing.
Was that really the same genre, like garage?
Yeah, so I was playing like UK garage, like dark sort of two-step garage, like the very, very early beginnings of grime, but pre-grime, it was still garage at the time. So I was doing pirate radio, and then, I was working in a bar, and I managed to catch wind of a job that was available in a record distribution company called Street Sales, which was based in Wandsworth, and they were like distributing a lot of UK garage, like at the tail end of the kind of the peak of vinyl, like independent vinyl sales. So I think it was about 2001 to 2002, maybe, worked there. Early 2001 to early 2002, and then the company, I decided to leave the company, and it folded shortly after that, actually. But in that year that I worked in distribution, I learned a lot about how to press vinyl. I knew, had the contacts at every independent store because my job was essentially selling vinyl to shops. So I knew a lot about the mechanics of releasing music. And by then, I'd kind of like dipped my toes into having a go at producing, because the production came for me off the back of hearing some of the DJs on pirate radio stations that I aspired to be on that weren't particularly good at mixing, and I thought I was a good DJ and figured that maybe writing some music would be my chance to get onto these stations that I was trying to get onto. Started to write music, and I formed Terror Rhythm Recordings in 2002, and the first release was 2003, so I've been releasing for nearly 17 years now. Initially just started to like put my own music out, but naturally kind of grew into me trying to sign records that I liked and put them.
How are you learning? How are you improving? So in like 2019, it's obviously like YouTube and there's online courses and everything. Like, how are you learning to improve?
Do you know what? I think a lot of it was trial and error at the beginning, knowing and seeing how things sold and knowing like what sold wasn't as much of like a drive, whereas that these days you need to like find your way into an algorithm or find your way into a playlist, or there are certain aims that you need to kind of like tick off. Whereas back in the day, it was a little bit blind in the sense that you made your music, you played some of it on the radio and maybe at some clubs, like, you know, even then it was like dub plates, there wasn't even like CDJs in a lot of the clubs. So we were cutting these tracks onto records to spin like one-off pressings of stuff. So you tested a little bit of it in the club and on radio, but the feedback wasn't like it was, like it is now. Your feedback was like, oh, you know, I might get the odd text message into the pirate radio studio that like, this tune seems popular. I've played it the last couple of weeks, and every time I play it, the phone starts ringing. Or that was about it, to be honest. And then beyond that, when it did eventually get to the stage of pressing it on vinyl and getting it to the shops, you didn't know if it was even selling particularly well until those shops called you and said, we need more because it's sold out. Unless you know, there was only a few sort of internet forums back then as well. So there was a couple of UK garage music specific forums back then. One of them was Uptown Records Forum, which was attached to the Uptown Records shop in the West End. And then there was UK Garage Worldwide Forum. And I think that they were there was quite a lot of active DJs. I mean, most people on there were like pirate radio DJs, like producers, budding producers, people who ran labels. Like, it was a small industry, but everyone was there. And a lot of overseas like interest, you know, like people who'd somehow found out about, God knows how they found out about it back then, but they did, you know, I guess like visiting the UK and finding out, listening to pirate radio. But yeah, because there wasn't really much of an infrastructure online back then, it was hard to know if you were having any success or not.
So when you were booking all these sets, how were you actually even getting spaces?
I think for me, initially it was, so when you're starting out on pirate radio, you kind of rely on the station to put on like events and bring you in. So if you're one of the like more popular shows on the station, or if they deem you to be like one of the better DJs, should they be paying attention to the people who are on their station, then they would invite you to like play at their night. So playing on some sort of like lower grade pirate stations back in the day, you were just kind of waiting for that one or two events they'd throw in a year and hope that you'd get offered a slot at that. And then it was just contacts, like people would be throwing their own parties. So like you would meet other DJs and MCs on the station, become friends with the people who were on before and after you, because they're probably the only people you'd really actually see. Apart from like listening to the station and texting in the studio yourself, like, who's this? Can I send you some tunes, kind of thing. So it was all about like human connections, a little bit about being online as well. I think some of my early gigs outside of the UK definitely were because I was one of the few people who maybe had music in stores but was also actively online and contactable through the forums and stuff. So I think initially for me, some of my early gigs would have come through that. People were like, oh, that's the guy who released that track. Let me hit him up. We've got a night in like Vienna. Do you want to come and play it? And so that was probably the most part of it, I think, just being visible, similar to like now in that sense.
Yeah, I was going to compare it with like the forums then were probably very similar to people on Instagram.
Absolutely.
We know a lot of artists that really struggle with the idea of being accessible. Mm. They think that being a large artist means you shouldn't be accessible. But do you think that's kind of broken down a lot more now because of social media?
I think people expect it now, whereas before it was like surprise. I always used to be surprised if I saw like that DJ I heard on the radio. Like back, the sort of first time we ever really started seeing these people was MySpace. Before then it was like, you know, that even on the forums is like it's still just someone's name. You didn't really know what they looked like unless you saw them in a club and actually physically turn up to the event. But then when MySpace came around, it changed that. Like, people shared a lot more of their personality, their kind of, like, brand. Branding definitely came in around then as well, because you had to design your page, and obviously your music was there as well. So the fact that you had all of that control and, like, a space to express yourself, it kind of introduced branding to a lot of, like, fledgling artists. A lot of us kind of, like, were very young when we went onto MySpace. I'd have been like I'd have been in like my early 20s, but yeah, I mean, some of the people that were on MySpace in their sort of like late teens, you know, it was like no rules back then. There was no rule book or like how to act or how to build your brand. There was none of that. So it was all completely DIY, a lot of trial and error. And yeah, I think that the more active people back then rose to the top very quickly.
Do you think it's easier now to get discovered and grow, or back then?
That's a tough one. Like, always think about this as well, because I think back then there was less places to be. So like your time and effort and energy was only taken up by MySpace, and then like you were making music, you know, beyond the end of your emails, MySpace, maybe the internet forums. Beyond that, we didn't have smartphones. You're not on the phone constantly looking at what everyone else is up to. There was a lot less information coming in as constantly. So in the sense that there's a lot more noise now, it's a lot harder to cut through that noise. You've got to stand out both musically, aesthetically, your personality. There's so many things in play now. Whereas back then it was kind of like, is your music good? Yes. Okay, like, how funny is this person online? Like, do I like this person? Yeah. And that was it. It was as simple as that. And there was a lot less, it felt like there was a lot less artists, maybe in the sense that there was just less people had access. Like, people were just getting access to all of the, like, cheap software. You know, it was still quite early for all of that as well. So when I got into making music, it was still quite, there was not many producers or MCs or DJs, because you needed to know your way around the kit, or you needed access to a studio that cost tens of thousands of pounds. Whereas now, like in the early 2000s, you could get like a cracked copy of software off of like LimeWire and have a go. And I think that opened a lot of doors. So in the sense that it's easier now to like be a part of the, like be on the field of play, but you really have to try and stand out, and there's so many people that you have to cut through.
I do get the impression there's so much more music released now than there was back then. Even though you can access more like cracked software and things like that back then, now it's like 40,000 tracks uploaded to Spotify a day. Yeah. It just seems so...
It's insane. And like, I try to give advice to artists who release on the label of the things that they should be doing, and a lot of them feel like they can't do enough. And it's like, I see everything you're doing and it looks great, and you know, be as active online as you can, like engage as much as you can with like people who are posting your stuff, like show support back in return to people who are putting you in playlists, and you can do all of that, but sometimes it still doesn't quite work, you know. And I think that we're still trying to crack some kind of code that's not quite noticeably like, what is the code?
Or doable,
exactly.
We often get asked questions about hacking things. So if you look at our earlier videos on YouTube, we use the word like hack and things like that, where you could easily work out there's just a tip that will fix everything for you. And I think now, because you could work every single minute of every single day, and there's still more you can do.
Exactly,
whereas when you first started making music, you probably just wanted to play live as much as possible. You wanted to make music as much as possible. But now there's always someone that you could be DMing. There's always someone that you could be emailing. You could be tweeting, and there's no excuse for not doing something.
You have to be constant now. I always say this to people, and like for me to still be working in the industry like as long as I have been, There's like peaks and troughs in your career as well, and you need to know how to ride those out and deal with the fact that you are going to go quiet for a little while. And it's then about like, how do you get back? How do you like become relevant again? Or what do you do? And there's so many little things that you can do, like saving money here and there, earning money here and there as well. And I find a lot of the people that are still active in the industry from when I started out are similar to me, in that like they'll be working in a label in the week, or they'll run an event on the weekend, they'll do some consulting, they DJ, they do their own press, like their friend shoots their music videos. It's like you need to have your hand in so many pies to just keep it moving to a standard that like is livable anyway, in my opinion. Unless you're like trying to like cross over into the mainstream, then it's a bit more, there's different things in play then. I think then you do need a little bit of money behind you to, you know, you can't do that on your own, in my opinion. Like, we've tried it with a couple of records that I thought were like surefire crossover hits, and all of the kind of like response from the people that I was always servicing with things before was like, this is incredible, this is going to be like a radio hit. And I'm like, yeah, definitely, I know it is. And you know, what am I doing differently? Sending it to like radio pluggers, sending it to these people. And then like that was costing a lot of money, but it was still not the level of money that maybe like a major label has to throw at that kind of release. And that's when you realize the difference between like having a great underground track that is played by all of the DJs within like a niche genre and actually like presenting something like that to your mum and dad to like listen to on their way to work. That is the difference. And I think that is where like major labels are still here, and that's why they're still here, because they know how to do that. They have that money, they have those contacts, and yeah, that reach.
What got you your first break then in the industry? Because I spoke to my friend saying, I mean, PlayStation later, and they know you, they've been to your shows and your sets. Like, what got you that break initially?
I think for me, it was like, it's a little bit of luck and timing involved. Like, obviously I was lucky enough to know how to make music at the time, and the sort of music that I was particularly interested in was like the end of the UK garage sound that got quite dark. I was on radio with MCs, so like it was like grime was starting to bubble. It was like the beginning of grime. So when you look back at like how things started, I just happened to be one of the people that is still spoken of to this day as like started, like one of the people that helped start the grime thing and the dubstep thing, which kind of started here in Croydon. So I was in between two really like important sounds, and I was friends with everyone in both of those sounds. And then in being on the radio, I got onto Rinse FM. That was like massively influential, was easily the biggest station for a lot of emerging electronic, urban, you name it, music has come through that station for... Yeah, I mean, just like playing music on there. So I had a weekly show on Rinse from 2003. I was doing Pirates before then, but then Rinse was like a next level of like Pirate. You know, it was a much more professional operation. They had a lot of good talent on there. Like, I used to try and tune into Rinse from South London, and it was in East London. You couldn't really pick up stations that weren't local to you, but there were ways and means of doing it, you know, like, but it was that important to me as a listener that I knew that being on a station like that would open doors. So I think for me, the first real break for me was getting on Rinse. That was almost like a seal of approval from that world of like underground music that was happening in London and around it. Being a part of that gave me the platform I needed to prove myself to like the sort of like the nerdier listeners of that kind of scene, you know. So then it was just about like just being as good as I could be at what I was trying to be and like what I wanted to do. I was obsessed with new music and being the DJ that played it first. So that was it. Like, I had a show on the best radio station and I had music that no one else could get, and carried on doing that for years and just solidified that. That was how it worked with the DJing. And then on the musical, on the production side of it, it again was like, I have this platform, I play at the best clubs, I have like one of the most listened to radio shows, my music, I need to make music that fits in with all this stuff that I'm playing. So I'm producing constantly, trying to like make a banger, trying to make a big hit, and had a few like that in sort of underground terms were really big. And you know, like, was working with a lot of MCs who went on to do great things. So, you know, like, I used to play shows with the likes of Wiley and Lethal Bizzle in the early days of grime. Toured extensively with Jamie and Skepta before Boy Better Know even was a thing. Like, we used to play shows every weekend, used to, like, hang out. Was going through old tapes. Like, we literally used to live at home with our parents, and we were just, like, kids, like, trying to make music. So it was just literally, like, I was so passionate about it that it didn't feel like I was ever really trying. There wasn't at the time like a goal. All I knew was that I wanted to keep like exciting people that were listening to me with like, wait till they hear this track. Like, oh, I need to make a song like that, or I need to get that person on the track.
So how did the collaborations come together? Because obviously your Skepta track is huge. That's kind of what people know you as best. Yeah. Was it purely based on friendships, or was it sometimes a little bit like someone introduced you to someone to create a song specifically?
So there's a bit of that, but I think a lot of the early stuff was literally we were all friends, and we were in the studio making stuff all the time. We're gigging together. So if he heard a track of mine that was like that beat, I needed to get on that beat. And then I signed a publishing deal with EMI back in, what year would that have been? I think that was like 2004 or 5. And in signing that deal, I had access to a nice studio with an engineer who could record like great vocals. So I was like, let me just book this studio out and like invite all the MCs that like I'm friends with to like come through. Because like we didn't have opportunities like that often. So it was like, what, free studio? I'm there. Like they would turn up, spend the entire day. Like, so the track with Skepta came about when I signed that deal. I called him. He was probably my best friend at the time. We used to hang out every week for like days, you know, like I would travel to his gigs, he'd come to mine. Yeah, it was just like we hung out a lot, so he was the first person I was going to call. And that's it. We recorded Intensive Snare in that first session, and then the next day he was like, I'm going to come back again tomorrow. And I was like, who else should we get? So he called Frisco, Temper T, Chronic and Esco, and we recorded another track the next day. And those two tracks ended up on my first album. And yeah, like these days, it's more like people know who I am now. So I get people come to me, it's like, can I get this beat? A lot of the time as well, like people want my old stuff because there's a lot of nostalgia around like grime, and all these young up and coming MCs like to sort of like pay homage to back in the day. So naturally I get a lot of people asking me like, can I vocal this like 10-year-old beat that you made? So I get a lot of that. But also I still am very passionate about finding new music, and a lot of the time it's me reaching out to new up and coming MCs that I think are good or going places and see if I can get them on a track before they blow up. Similar to what happened with Skepta. Like a lot of people ask me, how did you work with Skepta? But like I worked with Skepta when no one knew who he was. Like, and that's what I always tell people now is like, if you know someone who sounds sick, work with them, because it's not always about like how big or like the reach of the person you're working with. It's the potential for that person to grow as much as it is for you to. So working with people like Skepta back in the day, you know, it was more because we were friends and I rated him and he rated me, and it just meant that with the studio sessions were fun and comfortable, and you know, we were honest with each other about, oh, that wasn't very good, like go and do that again, or oh, like you need to change the snare, I don't like that snare. Or we were just like honest with each other, and we got good results for that. And I'd say that now, you know, there's loads of producers out there that are desperate to work with like their favorite rappers, but I think that like there's a lot more gold out there if you just like start digging around for those artists who are hungry to like release their first EP. You know, you might have heard a few tracks on SoundCloud, you might have heard them on the radio. Like, hit them up because they're hungry and they're ready. And if you're ready to work as well, you'll get stuff done. And if you make something good, they could be the next Skepta, you know?
Yeah.
And the artists you said you're reaching out to now, are you signing them to your label now, or are you just kind of working with them in collaboration?
Yeah, do you know, I've never really like been one. Personally, like my experience of like releasing on other people's labels was always kind of like, I'm friends with the people who run the label and I'm doing it because I like their label. And I kind of run my label still like that a lot to this day. So I've never really been one to like ever tie anyone in long term. I'm like, we'll release some stuff, and if you like how we work, I'm down to listen to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing until you're not happy or until you feel like you want to do your own thing. So I'm always like open to releasing stuff on my label, but I never like pressure an artist into doing that, because I think now especially it's like it's easy for someone to self-release something. So like the idea of telling someone that you want 50% of the royalties or something is like, they'd be like, well, why would I do that? Then, and for me it's like, there are still a lot of positives to working with labels so long as the label is not trying to do you over. So I don't ever want people to think that I'm trying to loop them into this like massive long deal. There's a lot of artists that I'd absolutely love to do that with and be like, I would love to like lock this person in for 2 albums, but I just wouldn't, it just, because I'm an artist myself, I just wouldn't feel right doing it. And so yeah, most of the artists I work with are kind of like on a track by track, release by release, or you know, like favors, like you jump on this and I'll give you a beat for your EP, and I don't need to worry about invoicing and figures. In fact, like sometimes you do want to do that, but with a lot of people I work with personally, it's still about just having a normal kind of friendly relationship. And it's like, do me a favor, like jump, give me a verse on that and I'll give you a beat for your thing. And I don't worry about the paperwork. Just like try and keep it as like friendly as possible. But yeah, obviously in this day and age, you can't work with everyone like that. And this is more of a thing that like I tend to do with people I've met a few times. And, you know, you get a feel for each other. Like some people don't like working like that. And in some cases, to even protect yourself, you should probably get some paperwork and do it that way. But yeah, like for me personally, it's always been about releasing people's music I like, but also who I like working with. Yeah, a bit of a mix of that. I think at the moment, a lot of the stuff we've been putting out is like instrumental. So it's mostly producers who. So it used to be back in the day that you'd kind of DJ first and then produce. But now it's a lot more the other way around, that you produce first and then you want to learn. You want to do gigs, you want to DJ, you want to play out more. And so, yeah, I'd say most of the people that are on the label now are like producers who would like to gig, get out there and do the like. Because obviously the money's in the live side of things, really, yeah. As well.
So how do you do like the marketing in the label, or do you sort of like consult the artists on how to promote themselves?
A bit of a mix of things, actually, depending on the release and the aim of it. And like I'm always quite honest with the artists about what, you know, I like to firstly ask them like what's your like goal with this release, because if I think that they're being unrealistic about it, I'll be quite honest with them and be like, I don't think it can do that. I see it here, I see it there, I think we can get this, and this for it. But I think like anything beyond that would be more like luck than like judgment. And then see what their reaction is to that, because if they're cool with what I'm saying, I'm pretty sure I can deliver, then I'm keen to then take that on and do it. Because I kind of know from the years I've been doing it what kind of people are going to pick this up, what magazines are going to get excited about this, what playlists might put this in. How likely is this to land in like a Spotify playlist? Who's featuring on it? These kind of things. So in a lot of cases, I do most of it myself, just using my own contacts that I've built up through the years. You know, like you've mentioned on your podcast before, if you build up that kind of like address book and like those relationships with the journalists, the bookers, the playlisters, like the people who can open doors for you, really. And I'm fortunate enough to have a big address book in that sense. Friends with a lot of radio DJs, pluggers, PR companies, videographers, you name it. So in the past, when I have paid for PR, I've always felt a little bit underwhelmed by what came back, because I'm like, paid a lot of money for that. And I know I could have done all of that myself. Like the results that come back are not things that I'm like, wow. I've always wanted to do that. Thank you. Like, I've never really paid for it and been like blown away. So more often than not, it means more money in the artist's pocket if I do it myself as well, because, and mine as well, as a label, obviously, any pennies that can be saved are shared at the end when the money starts coming in. So with most releases, I like to try and do as much as I can. If I don't think I can do it myself, then I'm quite clear, plain, with the artists about how much it's going to cost to get what you are saying done. And then it's a question of, do I want to take that financial risk as a label? Because we take all of the financial risk on up front, obviously. But then, yeah, I'm always open to then, if the artist wants to go and self-release, I'm quite happy to help them set that up as well. To a point, obviously, I can't work on the release as if it were my own after that. But like, I'll show them how to set up with a distributor, tell them what to expect to pay for artwork and stuff, like just to make sure they're not getting ripped off somewhere. Because unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there that, you know, there's never a price for anything in this industry, not a set price. No one's clear and obvious about their pricing, and that is a dangerous trap to potentially fall into.
We have Alex actually wrote a blog post, and it was like how to avoid the bullshit.
Yeah.
And we've heard of so many companies, and the first thing they say in an email is, what's your budget?
Yeah.
And it's like, if you have a service and a time that you're working on something, your time is worth a certain amount of money, so how much is that?
Exactly.
And it's crazy how this industry very much has a lot of people that just want to exploit the vulnerable emerging artists.
Definitely.
Obviously you have your contacts, so you probably know which people to trust, but do you have any advice for people that are struggling at the moment? Because there are a lot of artists getting ripped off with even simple things like artwork.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I think it depends with artwork. If you've kind of got like someone in mind, if this person's like an established artist in their own right, you can expect that's not going to be cheap. But there are a lot of very good, talented graphic designers out there who are all over Instagram, all over DeviantArt. You know, like they're everywhere. You just look for them. A lot of them are students as well. You know, like trying to get their name out there. They want the support and like promotion as much as you do, but they should still be paid for it the same way that like the artist should be paid too. I find that like an honest kind of amount for like digital artwork, if you're just talking about like a kind of front cover for your EP, I found that that can range from a great like cheap bargain. I've managed to get like someone charged me like $70 for what I deem to be an amazing piece of artwork, and then I've paid up to like $400 for like hand-drawn, very specific, but like this is an artist that we've developed up to this point. All of his artwork is drawn by the same person. I believe that, you know, the reason I did it with him was I was really into his music when he first sent it, and he had nothing online, and I thought, right, you're in an absolutely beautiful position here, and like you've sat on some really unique music, I think a lot of people will like it, you've got nothing out there, like this is like, if I was an artist, if I had your music, what would I do? And with him, I used like the Gorillaz as a really good example of, you know, people know what your music straight away. Like we were talking about cutting through the noise, you can see a Gorillaz release in like your stream of music on SoundCloud, Spotify, because of the artwork. It continues always. It's always got that same theme. The characters drawn by the same person. So I was like, do that. You know, that kind of, as a producer, you don't have a face and like a personality as much, but if you can own a kind of visual style, that's a step in the right direction straight away. So it was, in my opinion, with this particular artist, using this slightly more expensive person is worth it, because now people recognise his music straight away. A lot of people love it. They buy prints of the releases like on Bandcamp and stuff. So it's paying off, I think, because it makes him look like an elite artist, even if he's still operating in an independent market.
And you mentioned kind of PR companies and doing it yourself. For a lot of people listening, they're looking to break, they've made music. For you, what are those factors that people should be focusing on to actually break an artist? What is important? Is PR useful in 2019 for an artist?
I think it is still. I think even at the base level, you should be at the very least like giving your releases a decent... A lot of artists rush music out. I mean, again, I've heard you talk about it on the podcast, how important it is to set up a release schedule, give times, like make sure that you've got something happening every week in the lead up to it. But then when it comes out, you want something every day for a few weeks, and then you need another, like a guest mix on the radio show the following month. A lot of artists release something, they want it out tomorrow, and then when it's out, they're already talking about when their next release is dropping. It's like, that one, people have still not heard that. Like, it's going to take months for all of your fans to even get round to taking that in. And your super fans will listen the day it comes out. But a lot of your, like, the medium sort of fans who might listen to you once every couple of weeks, they're not going to hear that for maybe a month. Don't start thinking about your next release until you've given that one time to breathe. And I think this is where PR is important. You know, these days, social media is obviously very important, but it's great if it's not just your voice constantly saying, I've got an EP out. If you can post something from an online magazine or like a blog post that someone else has said, I've listened to this and I love it, and I think that like if you like this and this, you might really like it, and if you like this, you should check out this. Like, it's so much nicer to be able to tweet something like that from someone else's perspective than just telling constantly your fans, my release is out. And this is where I think PR is still important, because it gives your releases a sort of perceived importance as well among the industry. Because even if like casual listeners are not checking Fact Mag out every week, or you know, following the right YouTube channels, then if they follow you and you're constantly posting all these other people saying how much they enjoyed it, then it's going to like draw them to, oh, I must check that out. I need to check that. Like, that must be cool. It seems to be popping off. Like, a lot of people are talking about that. And it's that crowd mentality that like naturally the whole world has now, that social media has kind of created, that like, if you're not in on it, you're missing out. Exactly. So it's like being in the press or being on a guest mix on a radio show or doing a mix yourself or like releasing a video or getting a big feature is great as well if you're a producer. Like, or obviously these are like dream things, like goals, but the more little things and stories and posts and places that it pops up, they're going to help like make your release seem really important. And if it seems important, it's going to get more ears on it. And that's the importance of PR still for me, I think.
And you mentioned social media. It's a little bit different, producers on social media, because a lot of them aren't really, their brand isn't so much the face.
No.
So how do you think social media works for producers? Because we often work with musicians, so often the answer is just about their personality and bringing that out a little bit more through the socials. How do you think it works for producers?
I always try and get them to like share a bit online, like, and that so many of them are like, oh, I don't want to do that though, that's not cool. And I'm like, but that's what people want. Like, and I think of myself as well, a lot of the stuff I share online isn't about a release coming out, but I'm always on Twitter, I'm always on Instagram letting people know what I'm up to, and I'm very aware that if I don't do that for a few days, it starts to get a bit quieter. And it's just like being your face being in people's feeds. If it's not your face, at least it's your music. Engaging, at the very least, I think engaging with other people on these platforms is a really good way to build a following, gather more awareness of what you're doing. You know, if someone tags you in a tweet or something like that, gives you something to retweet, if you then engage back, then they think, oh, that's cool, like, I got a reply. Then they're more likely to engage next time you post something. And you know how algorithms work. These are things that are then more likely to be shared to other people's feeds. And someone who might have heard of you but wasn't following you might then see you on the newsfeed and be like, oh, I must follow that guy. Like, I listen to their releases and I've heard that, like, oh, that's that guy, put that EP out. Or, oh, that's that singer that I like. Oh, I need to follow her, she's sick. Like, that's what you need to be on social media for, as much as that is long. But I think that it's like momentum. When you've got that momentum and you've got that following, you can be less active on it. And then when you are active on it, it's engaged with more. So I think initially it might be a bit daunting because you're essentially like shouting at nobody on there, because everyone starts with zero followers. And getting those first few followers, I think, is engaging with the people who are already existing on the platform. And yeah, you might go a few weeks of like zero engagement, zero followers. But just sort of following other people, replying to what they're talking about, also just supporting other musicians, retweeting other musicians' stuff, sharing the stuff of theirs, other people's that you like. Whether you feel like it's relevant to your audience or not, doesn't matter. It's more like showing that support for other musicians who are in your movement or your scene. They're way more likely to then, your EP drops, oh, check out like my friend's EP, I love this track, you know.
Same as the forums, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
It's if you're involved in the community that you eventually want to lead, you're gonna end up leading it.
Exactly. And I think I used to promote nights as well, and another like tip for like getting gigs as well is, as a promoter, I would get hit up by people all the time. Oh, I'd love to play your night. Like, the lineups look sick. Like, love to play it. If you say that to me at the venue, I'm way more likely to book you because I saw you in there. You came down and, you know, you helped like make the room busier and you checked out the opening acts and you came and showed your face. Like, now I'm much more happy to like give you a slot at my gig than someone who just saw the lineup and would love to have a gig, you know. So yeah, it's still about, I think like physical interactions are like a million tweets. It's still like, if you can go down and actually meet someone and say, I loved your EP, this is my favourite track, I write music similar, like, here's like a USB, I'd love to get your advice on it. Or even if it's not a USB, you know, like, if you can shake hands or meet someone that like you're into their music and go up to them and tell them your name and say, I'm going to send you something tomorrow, they will remember you. No matter how many people they bumped into that night, if you then pop up on Twitter and it's like, hey, it's me, I met you at the nightclub last night, here's my tracks, I'd love you to hear them, I think you might like them, then they're way more likely to listen to it than if you just blindly send an email, I think.
And you're someone who's come through the industry. Actually, it's funny, you talked about engagement. The reason we're here today is because you engaged with one of our posts.
Yeah.
And you actually tweeted us and you disagreed with one of our opinions and then we kind of debated it. And what it was actually about kind of income in the music industry and how artists actually make money. I'm actually interested to know your opinion on where those income streams for artists are now in 2019 with kind of streaming being so low. Where kind of is the money?
I think it's still in performance, although like there's less space to perform in now. So that's becoming a difficult thing for artists to get into and start earning like a fair amount of money. So I think with streaming, it's like it's not really getting any better apart from the fact that there's more people using it, and I think more people are paying for it now, which is great. I think the good thing about streaming is there's no overheads. You know, you don't have to keep pressing CDs or keep an eye on the stock or like keep going to the post office, or it eradicates all of that. So if you can build up a decent following and then you can build your catalog, you can be quite sustainable, I think. Spoke about an artist on my label earlier who had this artwork. His name's Clacy Jones, and he finds himself consistently down about how he's doing, but in my opinion he's doing really well. I think he puts a lot of pressure into like landing in a Spotify playlist or something like that, and I think a lot of artists do as well. They feel like they've failed until they've got into New Music Friday or a specialist's playlist, like a curated playlist. And he hasn't really found himself in those, but he does have nearly 50,000 monthly listeners, and a lot of them come from his own like playlist on his artist platform. He puts a release up, and you know it's doing like 1,000 streams a day, like without even. He's not very hot on social media, but the people who are into his music are really into it, and he's just got to keep that going. I think if you just keep that going, keep the quality high, you know, keep the people who are like committed to listening to you happy, and make sure you've just got a nice constant stream of good music coming out, and the quality is always where it should be. You know, he's gonna keep the fans that he's got, and he's just gonna like keep building more. Like people, he's in so many like user generated playlists. Like some of them get him thousands of streams as well. There's some big ones. So I think a lot of artists are putting way too much pressure on being in like a curated playlist. Like I found myself in a few recently, and I can compare them with him to his best performing track, which is in no playlists. I've got a track in Spotify's Metropolis playlist at the moment, which has 600,000 followers, and he gets more streams on his best performing track than I do from that playlist. So it's not the be-all and end-all of like success on Spotify. I think it's just about, you know, being patient and sticking to your guns. Bandcamp is a godsend. I think like I can't big up Bandcamp enough. The label makes more from Bandcamp per month than it does from Spotify, because we push a lot of our listeners to Bandcamp, and we communicate that if you really want to support the label and the artists, paying there is better because the money lands instantly in the bank within seconds of them paying for the release, and then they can stream it on the Bandcamp app as much as they want after that. But DJs use Bandcamp, and obviously the music that I put out is electronic music. DJs need files, you know. They're not listening. They might listen to it on Spotify because they're in at work in the week, but they need it to play it out. So they need to get it from Bandcamp. Bandcamp, the nice thing about buying from Bandcamp is knowing that you're putting that money straight into the label. They don't have to wait 3 months for the accounts to come through. You know, the money's straight in their PayPal by the end of the day. Bandcamp takes about roughly 10% of their sale. So I think that's I think for artists as well, yeah, I definitely recommend being on Bandcamp as well as being on all these streaming platforms. It's one that distributors don't deal with, so you have to do Bandcamp yourself. But if you can get, I listened to a great audiobook called 1,000 Fans. I don't know if you've ever heard about that, but a really interesting stat was If you can get 1,000 people to pay £10 for an album, that is this equivalent of the same 1,000 people listening to your album on repeat 5 times a day, every day for an entire year. So if you can just get 1,000 people to buy it, it's way more powerful than getting probably even 20,000 monthly listeners on Spotify, because most of your monthly listeners might only listen to that album once or twice in a month. Listening to it 5 times a day, every day for a year is not happening, even with, like, you'd have to almost leave it on all day constantly and never listen to anything else for a year. So just paying an artist £10 for a download on Bandcamp is still the best way you can support artists that you enjoy. But it, from an artist perspective, I think, like, entering on that sales, on the sort of sales model is really good, because I find, like, if we can come, if I can keep costs down from a label perspective as well, if I can sell maybe 40 to 50 copies of that EP on Bandcamp, it puts it in profit straight away. So then anything they make from streaming is all profit after that. So we upload everything to SoundCloud. We still put everything on all of the free platforms, because I find that the free platforms are all about being discovered. But your core fans, your real fans, if they really want to support you, they'll buy it. They'll buy anything that you put on Bandcamp. You can sell merch on there. You can message your fans as well. It's got some really good tools in the artist app where you can actually, like, filter your followers or your customers by how much they've spent. So you can reward anyone who spent the most in a year or something like that. Like, you can private message them. It goes to their email. So you can literally message your top fans, your top supporters. And this goes back to engagement. This is the kind of like real engagement that's going to, like, have a lasting impact on said listener. If they got an email from their favorite artist that said, "You've spent so much money, like, supporting me, thank you. Here's guess this for my show," because you can see their location as well. Like, "I'm playing here." So that's another thing that it's good for as well, is having access to, like, that data, but also access to the listeners, which you don't really get with any other of the streaming platforms. And I feel like this is maybe where streaming platforms are missing the mark a little bit, and maybe alienating themselves from artists feeling like they're supported, really, is that you have all these enormous followings. You can't actually reach them until you release again. And then there's no message. You can't sell the story of the album, or here's, like, some behind the scenes, or here's that. No streaming platforms are really, like, giving artists that kind of, like, two-way, you know. I feel like that was one thing we missed a bit with MySpace, was that artists had that opportunity to do that. Now they have it, but it's scattered across multiple platforms: Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, streaming platforms, Bandcamp, blogs, website, whatever. There's so many places that you have to, like, spread it everywhere. But it's not. It would be great if there was, like, a one hub that everyone could kind of, if you want to pay for it, you can pay for it. If you want to stream it, you can stream it. If the artist wants to upload a blog or a picture, that'd be great. But we're just missing that a little bit. So yeah, I think that's, like, maybe where we're at with streaming is just, it's almost there in the sense that it's great for listeners, but it's maybe not quite good enough for artists just yet. But yeah, just building the catalogue and recognising that the fans out there that listen to you are, like, important as well.
Yeah, we always say that just the streaming platform should just be treated as a discovery platform.
Definitely.
Just because, like you said, you can have millions of streams, but that doesn't mean you've got a million people watching you closely.
Exactly,
because
yeah.
We have artists that come to us with millions of streams, and we'll go check them out at a gig, and it can be an empty room.
Absolutely.
And it's trying to collect that audience and push them somewhere. And obviously for your artists, ideally it would be Bandcamp, because that's where money can be, but for a lot of indie artists, like indie rock, indie pop, it's probably more like the Instagram and the Twitter.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just sort of being able to collect those people and sell something. But how are you getting people to Bandcamp so far? Is it they already have an existing audience?
Yeah, I think a little bit of it, it's getting better actually. Bandcamp, as a sort of sole platform, has a really good kind of front page that, so it's kind of like a blog as well. So we've had some stuff land on their front page. So we've done some sales from that, not like masses of sales. I say most of our Bandcamp traffic actually comes straight away from SoundCloud. So most of our followers, I think, I don't know how many followers got on SoundCloud, but like, I want to say it's about 30 or 40K. And all of those uploads, there's a download button, and the download button directs them straight to Bandcamp. And I don't know what the conversion rate is like, but the click-through rate's good. I can see from like our Bandcamp stats that the majority of people that land on our page have landed there from SoundCloud. So I'd say like building that SoundCloud following in the kind of peak SoundCloud era was like key. It's not as good as it was. Like, you know, we're not getting big numbers on SoundCloud still like we used to.
We get that question a lot actually about SoundCloud. How do you promote artists on SoundCloud? And we kind of admit it's not our area. Do you have any advice for artists?
Do you know what? It's changed so much in recent months and years that like I'm not sure what to do differently in there anymore beyond just doing what we always used to do, and that was just putting the music up and getting the artists to give it a repost and hoping that it picked up as many reposts really as it could get, because that was the main difference, you know, like you can get as many likes as likes weren't really making any difference. If people were reposting it, more people were seeing it, more people were reposting it, more people were seeing it, then you pick up a few follows and reposts were like the most important thing.
Is it possible to do like an influencer marketing campaign on SoundCloud where you pay for?
I thought about this once. I thought of like almost like a pyramid scheme for like influencers, DJs, like where, because there must be a way inside SoundCloud that they can track every repost and where it came from. So let's say like, for example, Diplo, who is like a massively influential DJ in electronic music and pop as well. And let's say he retweeted or reposted my track on SoundCloud, then suddenly his repost has then landed on like millions of people's and millions of other DJs and people who are also influencers who might then repost it from their stream onto their like newsfeed. There is essentially like a tree then. You can trace back like who put that on Diplo's feed. That person should be like rewarded for Diplo discovering that artist on because of your repost. So there's almost like a hierarchical like influencer tree that is probably visible like to SoundCloud, and I feel like if they could monetize that some way so that people engage more with their platform, like you imagine like it wouldn't need to be a lot of money because streams are not a lot of money, but if people were more likely to build their following on SoundCloud and then support something that they think is cool, knowing full well that, oh, Diplo follows me on SoundCloud. If I repost this and then he does, I'm going to be like responsible for tens of millions of people seeing that song on their feed. Therefore, I get £2 at the end of the month, which is unfortunately the kind of figures we're talking about in streaming terms these days. But it might engage people with their platform a bit more. I used to engage with it loads. I used to live on SoundCloud. When I was on Pirate Radio and Legal Radio as well, I used to literally live on SoundCloud trying to find tracks. It was the best place to find stuff. In most cases, you could download it as well. And if not, you can message them directly and get a copy of it. So I was like finding 90% of the music I was playing on the radio on SoundCloud. And then those producers were hearing their music played on the radio by me, who had a really big audience on Rinse FM and on SoundCloud. Because of that, all of the producers that I was supporting in my radio show were reposting my radio show to tens of thousands of people, and we were racking up like 50,000-60,000 hits some weeks on the radio show because of that support that was like regurgitated through the SoundCloud community, because I was supporting so many producers who were like active on it. And they were listening to it every week because it became a show to like find stuff that was just in SoundCloud. And I became obsessed with it. I just literally spent days in there. Find an artist. Oh, this is interesting. What are they listening to? Go through who they're following. What's this? Oh, that's cool. How have I not heard of that? What's this? Like, what is this sound? And then suddenly you're sort of supporting more and more of this music that no one knows what it is, but it all kind of sounds like it makes sense together on the radio show. And then people are talking about it, like, is this a genre? Like, so we had a genre born out of the radio show called Wave, which even got recognized on Spotify's year end like wrap up this year. like 4 years since it kind of like started to pick up that buzz. But it's only really now that like platforms are recognizing it as a genre. But that was born out of SoundCloud, just kids making lo-fi kind of like trappy, sad boy, instrumental beat, like type beat stuff. And it was just like such a golden spot to find music. And it could, I don't know why it's not still there. They got rid of a lot of really good functionality in there, like groups, which are really good for like sharing music and like-minded people of like different tastes. They got rid of that.
I feel like they wanted to become more of a streaming platform now.
Definitely, yeah.
And I feel like that was a really bad move.
Yeah.
Because they weren't.
No.
It was a bit of a mix between like a streaming platform and a social media platform.
Yeah.
A bit like MySpace.
It really
was
because it was like no one was really thinking that much about what they were uploading.
Yeah, no one really cared. Whereas now people wait till they've got the finished product. As if it's Spotify.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's not really discoverable because you'd rather just stream it on something like Spotify. Exactly. Where it's easier to stream something that's like a full catalog.
It always makes me laugh when I see like a SoundCloud upload go on and the link's like, listen to it on Spotify. And I'm like, I'm already listening to it on SoundCloud. I don't need to go to Spotify. But I'd like a file. Like, can I download it somewhere? And then maybe I'll click through. But yeah, I 100% agree with you on that. It was like a really good discovery platform. And now it's just the same as everyone else. And they've lost their identity a bit. So it's almost like, where it was great to like, oh, get heard by DJs and other people and other producers, now it's like, that's lost. So this is just like a bad version of Spotify. Or, you know, it's got this amazing community of people on there that are just not really engaging with it that much anymore. And it's sad because it could have been perfect. It really was like, it could have been the streaming platform that also allowed downloads. Like the way the stream works, it was social, it encouraged you to share music that you were into. No other streaming platform really has that. But Spotify, SoundCloud had that, and I don't really know why.
They also had a facility for licensing music in a way as well. Yeah. I remember a lot of our YouTube videos, we're able to download it. It takes us to like a gate, click gate, and then we're able to then go and buy it. So you can link to different websites,
exactly,
you can download it. Mm-hmm. And that was awesome for us as well, and awesome for us.
Yeah, we did I did a sort of free music platform. It fizzled out quite quickly. It was like became a lot of work, but we used to put people, it was like free to download the music. It was available on all streaming platforms, but if you want it, if you're a DJ, it's free. So it was almost like the anti record label. I was still putting good music out, but it was like, it's free to download, and if you want to use it in the background of your YouTube videos, it's also free. So it's completely free, but any money that we make from streaming will be split with the artists. So only released 3 tracks on it, just because I ran out of time and had to get involved in other things. It's something that I might pick back up, but I think one of those tracks is in like a major Spotify playlist. So like, as much as we gave it away for free, never sold it, it's generated more income than a lot of releases I've put out on the record label, even though it was like, it's free, and it's free on YouTube. So we went back to that the time I reached out to you guys, and I think the point that I was making was actually about YouTube. I remember you mentioned it was like, you know, don't monetize on YouTube, let people put their videos. And I was like, actually, we earn a lot of money from a particular track. A kid that was opening like Pokemon cards on YouTube had used a track from our label completely unknowingly to me until the statements start coming through. It was a really obscure song. It was almost like an intro, like 30-second long kind of intro, like flurry that was on this EP. And this kid was using it to his millions of subscribers on this Pokemon channel. And it was racking up like thousands every month just from YouTube. Like unbelievable amounts of money, because this kid's uploading almost daily, just himself opening packs of Pokemon cards. But each video is getting hundreds of thousands of plays. So he was racking up like maybe like 8 million plays. And our distributor was picking up every penny of that monetization. So there's arguments for and against, but I think like on the main part, you're probably right. You're probably better off just letting people put your music in, but then every now and then you get that potential. So we've actually licensed music to YouTube creators as well, using Label Engine as a distributor. You can actually set up splits, so they can actually pay the content creator a percentage that's agreed. So that's been quite nice. We've got a few through that, but yeah, like I find a lot of those sort of like free promo kind of, we worked with a really big YouTube channel called Stora, which is like a free running, I think they've got like 4 million subscribers last I checked, and they were using a lot of music from an artist on the label, and they weren't looking to pay, and I was like, the money he could make literally from just having that music in the background of one of their uploads is like, we're talking like hundreds of pounds every month just from that video. So then it was like, I don't want to give it to them for free, but maybe I can get like a few hundred quid, because then it's still beneficial for them, because they know they're going to make thousands from said upload. At least the artist gets a little bit of pocket money for, like, you know, their work, because the click through from things like the having the artist in the description is so bad. Like, we've tested it by using like Bitly link, so you can see how many people have clicked it in the description and stuff like that, and like the video will have like 8 million plays and it's been clicked like 13 times. So like having your music just in the description was not, I just couldn't see, I was just like, I can either do that and get it in there for free, or I can just ask them for like 100 quid and it's going to be way better than like, because even if every person that clicked that link paid for the EP, it still wouldn't be as much as like 100 quid, and the content creators are like raking in tens of thousands from that upload. So it just felt a bit fairer to me to just ask for a little bit of money, and I think that if you don't ask for too much, they're quite happy to pay, because they know full well if the music's like that unique and it's not just like a really basic background music beat, they've probably cut their video to it, they really liked it, they'd rather just pay that money and keep that cool music in their video than just get a free beat from off the internet somewhere.
And to finish things off, what do you kind of see the future for the music industry, because as you've been in it, so many changes have already happened.
Yeah, it's
what
mad.
what do you expect to happen next? Have you got any
guesses? Know, you know, it's a tough one. I don't see music it can't get any cheaper for the listener. If it does, I don't know where the money's going to come from. If it gets any cheaper, we're just going to be seeing ads on everything, you know, like, you know, we've already seen brands trying to release music, like albums and stuff like that. I don't think that quite worked out. I think like we're going to see much more of a rise in like independent artists. But I think like one thing that we're seeing a lot of at the moment is that's like perceived independence, which is basically artists who appear to be like independent all the way, but have like these enormous publishing deals that and like 360 distribution deals. It's just a major label deal repackaged as like a distribution deal. All it means is the label can't say no to your album. That's literally it. Like, that's the only difference. They're still going to like throw 400 grand advance at you and pay for all your videos and pay for your tour, which is recuperable, but that's just going to be on the publishing side and not on the label side. So I think we see more of that, more artists that like appear to be independent but like operate right next to the major label artists, which is an interesting, I think we're there already though, to be honest. I think a lot of the major acts now are kind of living that independent label wise but there's a major like financial backer behind them, so I think we'll see more of that, and I think that there'll be an independence involved in that as well, whereas like people will almost be like crowdfunded by like like venture capital stuff like that, you know, like pitch yourself as an artist to like a venture capital firm who will like, yeah, we'll give you a 50 grand like loan for 15% of like your touring, and
do you think that's going to get really messy though? There's,
I think it will,
because if you think about how many vulnerable artists there are right now,
yeah,
we have a Facebook group where we direct people to ask questions and then we answer them all day, and it's got 500 people in it so far, and we had one question pop up saying, how do I get an investor?
Yeah,
and loads of people were really engaged with that question, and they were so curious. But I think that's a bit dangerous, because if you're relying on an investor, you're getting yourself in more and more debt. You might as well go get a loan out from a bank.
Absolutely.
It's just as dangerous.
I think it's just like the way it's going is like people want to earn a living from music, and will be very quick to walk away from like a cushy job if it looks like they can just do music. But the problem with that is like music money doesn't come every day. It comes like 6 months, 12 months in a lump. You don't know how big that lump's going to be until that check comes in. And so this is why I think like things like venture capital is going to come in more, because artists want an advance, but they want to feel like they're still independent. And I think that's where maybe venture capital might come in, because I think from the outside looking in, the industry looks like a cash cow. So like people with money will throw money at it thinking that they're going to get like return on their investment. But in reality, it is an enormous industry, but it's kind of like it's owned by a very small amount of artists, you know. You know, the Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés of this world like probably own about 5% of the entire industry. So getting behind an artist who actually needs money, that is going to be where it's going to be interesting, because a lot of artists who are perceived to be like on the right track, you know, we've seen like with things like cancel culture and stuff like that as well, like an artist can be worth 50 grand a set, can be worth nothing the next day. And that's the risk that I think that VC maybe would see. But I think it's dangerous for artists to get into that. Like you said, I think, you know, get like loans and funding, or maybe, you know, like Arts Council funding, that kind of thing is probably the better route to go than getting involved in people who are not like invested in the industry. If they're invested in a person, they don't really know what they're going to get back for their investment. So I think we're going to see some of that. I think streaming is going to continue to be the big player. Interested to see how hard Amazon goes in this market, because they've got money. But
with the power of Alexa,
exactly. Absolutely, pairing it with Amazon Music subscription, and also like if that ties in with Prime, because that will be really like interesting, because a lot of people have Prime and Spotify, or Prime and Apple Music. If Prime plus Amazon Music is only like an extra couple of quid, and they've got the same access to the same artists, I wonder what an effect that will have on Spotify, YouTube Music, Apple Music, Tidal. That'll be interesting to see how they enter the market like properly, because they're there, but they're not really there just yet. So I'd be interested to see what happens with them. Blockchain is an interesting one. I think that the world needs to kind of allow blockchain to happen before music will really see the benefit. But I do think that it has a lot of benefits from what I've looked into, a lot of good ideas, and a lot of like ownership of things like rights, licensing. It would eradicate a lot of piracy problems, and a lot of paperwork. A lot of artists are really bad at paperwork, and if things like blockchain can literally like write the paperwork that your music lands into, like naturally. So if blockchain can be embraced by another sort of like tech, someone who's like you know, if someone who's experienced enough at say Spotify came in and was like, we're going to do a blockchain version of SoundCloud where you upload your files and suddenly like your music is available to all content creators, everyone, whoever wants to use it, wants to go in a film, they don't need to speak to you, you set the parameters, it's based on like its value as like within the industry, not, you know, like, then no one gets ripped off on any end, everyone's legally looked after, it's unhackable, it's kind of like, it's like a contract is set in stone. So I think that's going to be quite an interesting one, and I think particularly for distribution as well, there's a couple of really good platforms out there that are talking about like splits. So a lot of platforms now coming around with automatic splitting for artists and all collaborators on a track. Personally for me now, like, paperwork is like the longest part of running a label still, accounting to artists for a release that has like an EP that has one track with five acts on it and the other one's got two, and someone's only bought a single but this person's bought the full EP, and well, this person needs to be accounted for that, but that's just a full EP and that's that. And it's like, wow, there's so many like iterations of like accounting I need to do for just like a four track EP. Distributors are now starting to set up this thing where like you can pre-register splits. So let's say this track has one producer is going to take 50%, and a vocalist is going to take another 25%, and a writer is going to take 20%, and 5% for the person who like rearranged the drums in the session. And you set that all in place at the end of every month all of that money gets split evenly exactly where it is. You don't have to do any workings out. So that is going to be a massive help for labels, for artists. I think the more paperwork that we can cut out, the more creative we're going to see artists being able to be again. And I think that's the next big step for me, is like, how can we like give artists more time to create? And I think like trying to find ways of like kind of solidifying all of this social media that you have to be on. Maybe there is a platform that is begging to be made that everyone just does go to, that is just like the go-to place, like watch, listen, book tickets, buy merch, buy downloads, follow, like even, you know, like donate, like everything all in one place. But the whole, it's not just artists on it, it's fans, listeners, and everyone feels like they're playing their part as well. And I think that goes back again to like that idea with like influencers on SoundCloud or something like that, you know, that would be a place that influencers could also kind of flex on, you know, sharing music they like to their followers. And it's going to be interesting to see how like this influencer thing kind of molds into the music structure, because I don't think it's really having a massive influence just yet, apart from like at the top end. You know, if Kim Kardashian plays a track in her Instagram video, you're going to naturally see a massive spike. But I don't think there's too many influencers that are like offering that as like a service yet. I haven't seen it. A lot of brands but have like been using influencers, but I don't know too many musicians that have paid someone like a grand to like play their video in.
Yeah, I mean, we've done it ourselves. We've done influencer marketing campaigns.
How did you find it?
We actually found that going out to being kind of just going out as a, you will like this track, it's free to use, is better because it comes across so much more authentic. Mm. The only times where we've actually found it's good and it's worked paid is TikTok.
Right.
So yeah. We did a few on Instagram, and we worked with some huge influencers, like millions of followers, who paid quite a bit of money. And the return just wasn't there because someone loves that influencer for their content and not just the music, whereas TikTok, they're there for the audio.
True, yeah.
So we have an artist at the moment where their track is literally blowing up on the platform. We've checked it just before we came in, it's about 42,000 people have used the audio.
Wow.
So it's blowing up, it's like her biggest release to date. And we were paying a few influencers after it had gone viral a little bit. We were like, let's pay people so it continues, and it's working. It's blowing up right now. So I think that could be the future of
definitely,
the influencer marketing. So it's based around the music rather than based around the creator.
I've literally just started looking at TikTok, and it does interest me.
Oh, it's worth looking into.
Yeah, I need to. I'll do some influencer marketing.
We've done a lot of videos on it, so plug that one.
I might see you on there. Yeah.
Cool. But I think that's a good place to end it. Where can people find you online?
At Plastician on Twitter and Instagram. And SoundCloud and Facebook, actually. So all Plastician, spelled Plastic Ian, if you have trouble spelling that. And yeah, like, so like the record label's Terror Rhythm Recordings. I think it's like / Terror Rhythm, which is a bit of a mouthful. TerrorRhythm.
We'll link that.
Yeah.
We'll link it's, that.
When it sounded cool at the time, but yeah, it's not like, I've probably advised people since to like make sure that you're, will brand or your name sounds and spells like it.
Ours is quite hard to spell as well anyway.
Burstimo's not too bad. I think you guys are all right.
But thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And if you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to leave a review. And if you enjoyed the video, make sure to hit that like button and subscribe. And we'll see you in the next one.